I'd like to focus on two questions that are found from Parshas Lech Lecha. So we know there's a lot to choose from in Lech Lecha. It's a very quick survey of the Parsha. You have the command of Avraham Avinu to leave Lech Lecha Ma'aretzcha U'Moladetcha U'Beit Avicha La'aretz Asher Araka, to leave his past and to start anew. And then the Parsha, both this week as well as next week, details for us the challenges that confront Avraham Avinu on his mission of bringing godliness into the world in this new land. We begin the parasha immediately with the famine, the ra'av that's found in the land where he has to go down to Egypt, and the trial of Sarah being taken by Paro. We then move to Lot, who joined with Avraham, being Avraham's nephew, who had so much cattle that, and we'll talk about the story today, that the two of them have to separate and go their separate ways. Lot lands up in Sodom, and then we have the war of the four kings versus the five kings, where Avraham saves Lot from the imprisonment. And then the parsha ends with detailing the bris ben havsarim, the peace of the covenant, very famous section, where Avraham Avinu was promised to land for his descendants after going through a difficult purification process called exile, the Egyptian experience. We had the birth of Ishmael, and finally the command of Avraham to have a bris milah, and the promise that Avraham and Sarah themselves will have children and their names are changed. With a parasha like this, so much to choose from, you have to be specific, otherwise you're going to lose focus. I'd like to raise two very simple questions and try to develop an approach so that when we hear the parasha on Shabbos, there's a message that's clearly being spoken to us that we can gain for our lives. Question number one is found in source number one. It's in the writings of Siva Shalom, Sloman Rebbe, Hasidic approach, where he quotes the Medrash on the pasuk of Lech Lecha to go. And the Medrash says, this is the third line, Breishit Rabba Lametet Tet, Amar Rabbi Levi, Rabbi Levi stated, Shtei Pa'amin, twice Ktiv, it states Lech Lecha. There are two times in Avraham's life that we have the command Lech Lecha. One is here, leave your land, and the other is by the Akedah, by the binding of Isaac. Lech Lecha, go to Eretz Moriah, to Mount Moriah, and bring up your son as a sacrifice. Says the Medrash, and here it's very interesting, I really want to focus in on the Medrash, and the Siva Shalom's question on the Medrash, not so much the answer. The Medrash says, the Ein Ani Yodim Ein Techaviva Im Hashnia Im Harishana. The Medrash says the following, we have two times he's told Lech Lecha, but we don't know which one is more Chaviva, more beloved in God's eyes. Which one is of a greater import? The Lech Lecha of leaving your land or the Lech Lecha of sacrificing the child? Or potentially sacrificing the child? So, continues the Medrash. Mima dechti, from the fact it's written, El Eretz Hamaria, Hareya Shnia, Chaviva, Mi'arishana. Medrash concludes that the second Lech Lecha, going to the Eretz Hamaria, the holy mount of Yushalayim, that challenge was more special than the first. The Nesivos Shalom's question on this, I think, is a powerful question. And it's the question which fascinates me that I'd like to deal with today. Ulechora, at first glance, he says by the asterisk, Tamua biyoter, it's very wondrous. Ech efshar lidmotam bichlal. How are we even comparing the two? What is the havamina? What is even the assumption of the Medrash? Halom yisayon ha'akedah hi lemala mikol ha'saga. How can you even compare which is greater? Clearly, if we would take a poll in this room, what's greater? The nisayon, the trial of Lech Lecha, or the trial of the Akedah? We clearly say it's the trial of the Akedah. Where does the Medrash even come to compare the two? I mean, we all know that the trial of Lech Lecha to leave one's land has not been a foreign concept to Jews. We've unfortunately, many people are immigrants, we live in a melting pot society, to be a little more PC, we're in a salad bowl society, whatever you want to call our society, whatever it is, but we're a society of immigrants. Unfortunately, we've also had in our history the Akedah, but clearly the Akedah is so much more greater than the trial of Lech Lecha. Question number one is, what is the Medrash mean? We're not quite sure which one's greater. The second question is, looking on a detailed level at the story when Avram and Lot separate from each other. Let's take a look, source number two. It comes from Shabbat Shirim, where Miller is quoting the Chumash itself when he says, "And Lot, who went with Abraham, Lot ha'olech et Abraham, also had sheep and cattle and tents, so that the earth could not bear them to live together. This is after they left Egypt, for their property was vast and they could not live together. And there was a quarrel between the shepherds of Abraham's cattle herds and those of Lot. And Abraham said to Lot, 'Please let there not be a quarrel between me and you, or my shepherd and yours, for we are brothers.'" In fact, Rashi on this, "Kanashim achim anachnu," they look similar. Their facial appearance was similar. "Look, all the land is before you. Please separate from me. Hiparin nam alai. If you go to the left, I shall go to the right. And if you go to the right, I shall go to the left." So here Rabbi Miller and Shabbat Shirim ask, I think, a very basic question, or really two questions. In this incident, it is the timing of the decision to part that is puzzling. What was there in the quarrel of the shepherds that finally convinced Abraham that they could no longer coexist in peace as they had done previously? And we know Rashi tells us that only from, based on the Talmud, only after Lot and Abraham separate does God really speak to Abraham and have a relationship with him. So it's very important that they separate. But what was it, asked Rabbi Miller, what was it about this event that this was like, so to speak, the straw that broke the camel's back, that now Abraham says to Lot, "You know what, we have to separate"? A more basic question, which Roy Miller touches on, is Avraham Avinu, whose home and tent was open to everybody. He was able to have everyone walk through his house. How is it possible that his own nephew he couldn't live with? If this person is able to influence hundreds of people and had such an open heart and relationship with everybody, no matter where they came from, they could be idol worshippers, as we see in Parashat Vayera, the three strangers that come. Why was he unable to live with his own nephew? And technical questions on this section. The first verse, "And Lot who went with Abraham," is very strange. We know Lot went with Abraham. It's clear from the end of Parshas Noach, beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, the relationship, and that they were going together. What is the Torah coming to add by saying, "And Lot who went with Abraham"? It would have been sufficient to say, "And Lot had a lot of cattle, etc." That expression, "who went with Abraham," needs to be understood. And the expression that "for we are brothers" seems to be the reason they need to part, that also has to be understood. So basically two questions. One question is a question on the Medrash. Why do we even think to compare the two? The story of the leaving from his father's homeland and the story of the Akedah. And question number two is, why now does Avram and Lot have to separate? And more detailed questions on this story. What I'd like to try to examine together is the personality of Lot. Sometimes we get so caught up in the main characters of a story that what we call, quote unquote, the minor ones just get short-thrifted somewhere along the line. The key to Lot is found in one line in the Siva Shalom, in source 4, and it's this one line that I'd like to spend the rest of the day explaining. Says the Siva Shalom, the asterisk top line, "The Yeshno Yetzer Hara," there's an aspect of the evil inclination which is a Bechinat Lot, which is the aspect of Lot. There's something called the Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination, which is characterized by Lot. He's the prototype of a certain type of evil inclination. What is this? This is the key. She'inyano, Eruv Tov Vera, the mixture of good and bad. That's Lot. Rabbi Leff, in his book Outlooks and Insights, points out in source 5, "Lot was the personification of Tohu Vavohu. On the one hand, he appeared to be righteous like Abraham. He baked matzahs and invited in guests, even at risk to himself. But in fact, the jumble of darkness pervaded his life. He chose to live among the wicked people of stone. Lot's mixture of good and evil represented the antithesis of Abraham's mission in this world." If we step back for one moment and do a very quick survey of Lot's personality, we see that this indeed characterizes Lot. Moving a little bit into next week's parasha, which is okay. Lot sits at the gates of stone. It is completely forbidden to take in guests. Completely. He risks his own life and insists that not only the guests come in to his home, have lodging, but he prepares a great feast for them. Now what happens? The people of Stone come around, encircling the home, insisting that he give them the guests to do with them what they would please. What does Lot do? He goes outside and says, do me a favor. These guests have come to my home. I'll give you my two unmarried daughters. Do with them what you would like. And as the Ramban there points out, what is going on here? We know clearly a person's first reaction and first loyalty is to their own family. Here he's giving up his daughters for these two strangers who are coming to his house. It's a mixture of light and darkness. And let's continue the story. They get saved, Lot, Mrs. Lot, the two daughters. And then we know Mrs. Lot turns into a pillar of salt. We've all been on tour guides where they tell you that that's the pillar of salt. We've all seen it, each a different one, but that's really irrelevant. And the two daughters and Lot are stuck in this cave. They believed it was a cosmogonic event that happened in the world. They were alone. Okay, so you're going to tell me Lot was drunk and his daughters made him drunk so that they would have this child. But if you read through the writings of Chazal, the second night he wasn't so drunk. And I'm not so sure how drunk he was the first night either. What's going on here? On the one hand, they're doing something which our rabbis describe as an aveir lishma, a sin for very good intention. They're trying to bring about a new world. They think the world is destroyed. But how are they doing that? It's an incest. This is the mixture of good and bad. This is the person who's walking with Abraham who chooses which place to live. The most despicable place on earth called Stone. Why Lot is such a fascinating personality. This prototype of Ur in Choshech, light and dark within a person, is because Lot is not just Lot. Lot is each and every one of us. And that's what I'd like to speak about today. The Lot, that aspect of Lot that's found within us. So anytime we want to do a study, the best place to begin is clearly at the beginning. The tree of good and evil that was found in the Garden of Eden. Source 7, Rabbi Tatz, Living Inspired. A striking question which must be asked is why is the tree referred to as, quote, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Surely it should be named the tree of the knowledge of evil. It is the source of evil in the creation. Why then is it called good and evil? But that is the point exactly. If the tree were of evil only, that evil would be so easily identifiable, so odious and hideous, that no one would ever engage it. It would be the most obvious thing in the world to avoid. It would never present a temptation, an ordeal. It's the knowledge of good and evil combined, confused, which is the problem. The tree combines good and evil so thoroughly that after its fruit is ingested, the human becomes a tangled knot of both elements. No situation is entirely clear thereafter. Never can we completely separate our lower selves, our vested interests, from our pure core dimension. When Adam confronted that tree, he was pure and the world was pure. Evil existed only as an objective, dispassionate possibility, external to himself. But when he ate that fruit, evil became internalized within himself and within the goodness of the world, and now the human mind can never resolve the doubts entirely. When Adam Harishon ate of the tree, good and evil entered into the person, or in Choshech, light and dark, in such an intermingling that there was no clarity of vision. And the best place we see this, it's a very famous example Rabbi Tatz brings, is what happens right after man eats from the tree in Source 9. He hides. Hides from Hashem, who was everywhere. How could Adam imagine that he could hide? He knew Hashem as no human has ever since, knew deeply that Hashem is all-seeing and all-knowing. How could he hope to escape by hiding? The answer is that he no longer sees reality clearly. On the one hand, he knows Hashem exists. Well, that's why he's hiding. But on the other hand, he somehow thinks incredibly that what? He can hide. what a most deeply pathetic figure he has become, hiding from that which he knows is inescapable and yet fooling himself anyway. Is that not the description of our lives? Having the knowledge God exists. Because you know God exists, you're hiding from him. But you also know that you can never hide from God. And it's this tension and balance that we live through. And that, Rabbi Leff explains, is the characterization of the Tohu Vavohu, the first 2,000-year period in which the world was around an era of confusion, of light and dark mixed together. And what the next 2,000 years, the era of Torah, is an era which distinguishes between pure and impure, light and darkness. And here he quotes a very beautiful Rabbi Leff, Baal Shem Tov, in Source 11. He says, the Baal Shem Tov explains that the Satan will be held culpable in the future, not for attempting to seduce man into sin, because that's his job, but rather for making the sin appear as a mitzvah. Thus we tell ourselves when we sleep late and miss davening with a minion that our sleep is a mitzvah. Our intention is only to learn Torah with a clearer head that day. This is the tohu vavohu of the Yetzer, where we do things that are wrong and we rationalize to ourselves that it's the biggest mitzvah that we're doing. It's the biggest mitzvah. Right? We hurt people because, say, in the end, we're really helping the person out. We're really doing them a favor. When the good and evil and light and dark become so confused, we don't see clearly what is right and what is wrong. Perhaps the most famous essay on this idea of the light and dark that is intermingled within a person is Rav Chaim Shulev of Sichos Musar. He has two essays called Ha'or V'Choshech Shebadam, Light and Darkness in a Person. At the beginning of the first essay, he lays down as the premise Source 12, K'tiv Ner Elokim Nishmat Adam. The candle of God is the soul of man, which means that man is a bechina of Ner Elokim, of great light. We are Chelek Elokam Imal. We have come from God. We have this aspect of divine within us that is so great, so powerful, such a bright light, so incredible, the light that is found within each and every one of us. I found, I think, an excellent description of what this light is about from a brand new book that I came across on Friday, and I thank Spoiled Chickens for this book. And it's really a lesson in life how spoiled chickens can be a great bracha. So let me indulge you for one moment, a very brief moment, in my story about my chickens. And I'll explain to you about this book because I highly recommend it. Friday morning, I sent my husband on many errands. And right when he came home, I took out my chickens to make chicken soup. And I smelled the chicken, and it did not smell like this is going to be my chicken soup chicken at all. So my husband just came home, and he said, do you want me to go back to the store? And since I did that chesed shiur last week, I felt really bad. That here, he was schlepping out all morning for me. And now I'm going to make him go back and pick up chickens. And I was home all morning. I said, no, I feel bad. Let me go and buy another chicken. And everything's hashkacha. Everything is divine providence. I went to the store, and I met a person maybe familiar to some of you, Suzanne Kest, who's also a very important figure in terms of teaching Torah in this community, a very special person, who's at the checkout counter. And she said, I'm so happy to see you, Shira. I've been meaning to call you for weeks. There's this great new book that I've been reading, that I thought about you, that you have to get. So clearly, I called up my husband from the store. I said, I'll be 10 more minutes. And I went and got this book. It's called The Jewish Self by Jeremy Kagan. And on top, it's called Recovering Spirituality in the Modern World. I'll be honest with you. I never recommend a book unless I've read it. I have not had a chance between my chicken soup and today to read the entire book. That's being honest. It's also called a shiur to prepare for today. I did get to around two-thirds through the book, and I think it's an incredible book. Incredible. I'm almost ready to stop my curriculum, my 12th graders in EULA, and just do this book. Because I think it is outstanding. But I haven't finished it, so I can't recommend it. Anyway, after that long introduction, let's get to his quotations.
How would you say?
My soup is delicious. Thank you. Thank you. Source 13. Our inner connection to an infinity which reaches beyond our individuality is not an incidental attribute or an icon of a particular culture. This connection defines our humanity. It is the only characteristic which distinguishes us from the rest of creation. Monkeys make tools and can be trained to recognize and exchange symbols. Dolphins play, and machines can be programmed to give sophisticated responses to questions. And this is, I thought, was so beautiful. And this is what we're talking about, the chelek elokam imal, the special part in us. But no animal will ever contemplate the divine root of its own being and consciously develop and integrate itself with that divinity. No computer will ever pray. To lose this inner connection is to lose our humanity. And he continues at the end of the chapter, where the book is about this idea of discovering the self. We are motivated to press against this limitation by the faint echo of a deeper self which cries out from below the surface. When we gaze inwards, we catch a fleeting glimpse of something not confined by the finitude of our world. We have all had times when we experience the self far deeper than the one we are familiar with day to day, whether through a profound closeness to another person, meditating on the beauty and power of a natural scene, or clarity, or in a moment of quiet inner peace, we have achieved a passing clarity that there's much more to ourselves and reality than we're normally aware. This is the chelek elokam imal. This, on some level, is what we're speaking about, of this tremendous powerhouse that's within us, this ability to connect with the divine because we mirrored, and we have within us this aspect of the divine. So on the one hand, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitt says in Sichos Musar, we are this power of light. We have this tremendous light within us. Ah, if we have such light within us, so then you can imagine what darkness we have within us as well. And there's that balance of light called darkness. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in Path of the Just, Mesil Shesharim, describes this darkness. And he says, for the evil inclination literally blinds his eye, the third chapter. And he quotes a pasuk from the Psalm, source 16, you laid down darkness and it was night. This refers to the world which is similar to night. 17, for the darkness of night can cause two types of errors. And we've all experienced this in relation to a man's eye. It may either cover his eye so he does not see what is before him, or it may deceive him so that a pillar appears to him as a man, or a man as a pillar. And we've all had this experience. If you see something in the dark and you think it's a certain item, and then if you flip the light on, it was something totally different. It just appeared to be something totally different. In like manner, of the earthiness and materialism of this world is the darkness of night to the mind's eye and causes a man to err in two ways. First, it does not permit him to see the stumbling blocks in the ways of the world. And second, this is the next page, which is far more severe, which is even worse than the first. The second error stems from the distortion of their sight so that they see evil as though it were goodness itself, and good as if it were evil. And because of this, strengthen themselves in clinging to their evil ways. For it's not enough that they lack the ability to see the truth, the evil staring them in the face, but they also see fit to find powerful substantiations and empirical evidence supporting their evil theories. Two problems. It causes us to stumble, and worse than that, it causes us to see that which is wrong as something right. Two examples from Tanakh, from the Bible, that might concretize this idea a little bit for us, of the interplay between the light and the darkness within a person. Example number one, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz brings, is of Cain. This is sources 19 through 21. Where we know that Cain is the one who took the initiative to bring a sacrifice to God, and Hevel followed suit, his younger brother. Cain understood on the deepest level that if God gives you a gift, so then what is right and what is conscionable is to return that gift to God. He understood this. He understood this relationship to God. It's this concept of the greatest amount of light. Now, what was the korban, what was the sacrifice that Cain brought? He brought the worst of his fruit. Now let's get real. How many people were around in the world? Very few. father, mother, brother. Okay, some sisters are flying around according to the Medrash, but very few people. What is he doing with all that fruit? It's going to rot anyway. But the darkness says, I'm going to give him my best fruit to God. On the one hand, he's saying what? I understand we need to give a gift to God. That's the or, that's the light. And on the very same moment he's saying that, he's also saying what? I'm going to give the worst to God. The light and the dark, they're pulling on a person at the very same moment. And that's the problem. The irbuvia, the mixture of light and dark, where we don't see clearly. We're hiding from God because we know God can see us. The second example, which is also a very powerful example, is Eliphaz, Esav's son, who right after Yaakov takes, I'm using a nice word, the birthright from Esav. Esav, not a happy camper, to put it mildly. And he tells his son, Eliphaz, to go kill Yaakov. So Eliphaz is in a quandary. On the one hand, his father tells him, murder. On the other hand, Eliphaz grew up under Yitzchak's tutelage, his great-grandfather, his grandfather, and he knows murder's wrong. So Yaakov was a good Jewish cop, says no problem. There's a halachic concept of ani chashuv kemet, a poor person as if he's dead, take away all my money as if I've died, you made everybody happy. You didn't really kill me, but you listened to your father. Okay. Says Rav Chaim Shalev, do you understand what's going on here? On the one hand, he has to listen to his father. On the other hand, he knows it's wrong. But it's much deeper than that. 24. This incident involving Eliphaz contains an even more profound example of the intermingling of light and darkness. The basis for his intended act of murder was the fulfillment of the mitzvah of honoring his father. The very light itself had been corrupted and distorted by the darkness. It's listening to his father, which is light. It's doing the command of Kibbutz Avayim. That is the thing that's telling him to do what? To murder. And that's when you have such an intermingling of light and dark that you don't see clearly. And he continues, he says, now we understand why it's precisely Eliphaz of all of Esav's children who was the progenitor of the wicked nation of Amalek. For the other children, only the wicked nature of Esav to propagate, which in itself cannot produce the absolute evil of Amalek. It was only in Eliphaz, who had studied under Yitzchak, and who absorbed his teaching, in addition to the evil essence of his father Esav, who would distort and corrupt the teachings of the Torah to such an extent as to transform them into the evil colossus known as Amalek. The essence of Amalek, then, is not merely evil incarnate, rather it's a fusion of evil and goodness, which forms a monstrosity which is not possible to be produced by evil alone. And as a side note, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz ends this essay by saying, don't think that if you add more light, you've gotten rid of the darkness. The darkness here is not just an absence of light. Darkness is an entity in itself. Like by Egypt, Vayamesh Choshech, they felt the darkness. The darkness has a character in its own right, that it's not only adding more light, you think that the darkness will leave. No, one needs to deal head-on with this darkness. Now, if we understand this concept, that we have within us this inner tension, this inner struggle, where on the one hand we say to ourselves, this is the right thing to do, and at the very moment, very same moment, we construe all these things that lead us off the right path, and we're living a life of good and evil at the very same moment, we can then understand with almost a very perplexing statement of Elijah the prophet, who on Mount Carmel, when he gathers the people together to tell the people, you know what, enough is enough, stop worshipping idols, he says the following to them. This is source 27. He says, "An mataya tempo schim al sheyasipim, how much longer will you hesitate between two doorposts? Im Hashem Elokim lechu acharav, if God is God, go after him. Vima Baal yet lechua charav, and if the Baal, this idol, is God, go after him." Can you imagine Elijah saying such a thing? Did you hear what he just said? He said, if you can't make up your mind, stop going between two ideas. In the morning you're worshiping the Baal, at night, in the afternoon you're worshiping God, or vice versa. So you know what, says Elijah? Make up your mind. If you want to worship God, that's great. And if you don't, worship idols. Worship idols.
How can you say such a thing?
But there's a tremendous amount of depth in this statement. The worst problem is when you're doing both. If you're just worshiping idols, so then there's just worship idols, then there's hope that you'll come back to God. Because if darkness is understood as darkness and light as light, so then there's hope. But when the light and the dark are intermixed together, then the light fuels the dark, and then we don't see anything clearly. I know I'm jumping the gun in terms of holidays. But that's okay. This, Rav Wolbe says in Alei Shur, is the essence of what Tisha B'Av is about. He says there are certain holidays of kiruv, of closeness to God, pure light. The holidays of Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, we just experienced, where you feel God's presence. And then he says there's a holiday of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is called a moed. It's called a holiday. And says Rav Wolbe, you know what the holiday of Tisha B'Av is? It's called a holiday of Rihuk, a holiday of distance. A holiday of distance? Yes, he explains. He explains the following. He says, and I'm summarizing now 31, 28 through 31. He says, when you're close, so then you know you're close. And when you're far, you know you're far. The worst thing possible is to think you're close and you're so far. And that was the problem, he explains, in the times of Bais Risha in the First Temple. The Medrash says, why were the people punished? Because they said, lo chatati, we did not sin. They weren't even able to admit what they've done was wrong. We're fine, we're great. Enough, we've done nothing wrong. Tisha B'Av is the time to step back and say, you know what? We're in darkness. We're in blackness. You're in blackness, you're in darkness, you're already so close to God. You're in this mixed area of light and dark, you're never going to get there. Because you don't know how far you are. And this is Sefer Ikrim that Rabbi Miller brings down in Shabbat Shirim, points us out in 32, where he says, the will to repent can be frustrated in two ways, according to Sefer Ikrim. One is if the sinner is oblivious to his wrongdoing, impregnable, therefore to remorse and repentance. The other is if he persists in justifying his sin, rationalizing it into a virtue, removing it from the category of sin and himself from the possibility of repentance. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we all know this experience. When we've done something wrong, our first immediate reaction is to do what? Rationalize. I know it happened to me personally. 2 weeks ago, I got a letter in the mail. And this letter was someone who I knew, who proceeded to detail something terrible that I did in public at one of my shiurim. And my immediate reaction was to say to myself, I know what I did, but it wasn't wrong. And I was absolutely right for what I did. Whatever it is, doesn't matter the story. That was my immediate reaction. And then I said to myself, what I'm doing is exactly this. I'm living with this fuel of Or and Choshech, light and dark. And it's much more difficult and much more challenging to step back and say, you know what? If somebody, an outsider, saw it as wrong, so there must be a component of wrongness in there. And what I need to do is to step back as an individual and say, well, perhaps I wasn't completely right. And an apology is necessary for that individual. And to thank the person who wrote me the note for pointing this out for me. And that's the way to grow. The ability to say you were wrong. And not always justify everything we do. And this is the key in understanding the separation of Abraham and Lot. What was the story of the shepherds that was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak? So the Medrash tells us, it sounds second paragraph in 34, that Abraham's shepherds were rebuking those of Lot for allowing their sheep to graze in fields not belonging to them. In fact, for committing robbery. In response, Lot's shepherds fabricated a chain of reasoning to deny any injustice in what they were doing, claiming that in reality the land belonged to Abraham, that he had no heir, and that Lo would be his heir. There was no robbery involved in their deed. At all costs, they were determined to justify their behavior. The neat structure of logic served only to this end. What was going on here between the two shepherds? Very simply. Us allowing our animals to graze on land that doesn't belong to us? Robbery? What are you talking about? Wasn't Abraham promised the whole land? Isn't Lot the only relative who's going to inherit Abraham? So clearly, if Abraham has the land, and Lot's going to be his person who's going to inherit, so right now the land belongs to Abraham. So right now the land also belongs to Lot. We can go anywhere we want. This is a philosophy of refusing to recognize what is wrong. It's a philosophy of rationalization. Continuing Rabbi Miller in 35, Abraham knew this tendency and feared its effects on his own household, that it might corrupt them and distort their clarity or moral vision. He also realized that this characteristic would make futile his own efforts to point out any wrongdoing on Lot's part. Lot had a closed mind and sealed conscience. And that's what it means that Abram and Lot were brothers. They resembled each other, but the resemblance was superficial, even in the moral sense. In those actions whose good is clearly distinguishable from evil, they were alike. But where the asterisk is, but in the depths of their hearts, the difference between them appeared, the one still torn by desires, distorting its perception, the other pure in soul and lucid in intellect. Abraham said at this point, Lot is not an individual who wants to grow. He lives a life of rationalization. He lives a life where Ur and Choshech, light and dark, are so mixed together that he doesn't even realize the life he's leaving. And if he doesn't realize the life he's leading, we need to separate because the influence could be very severe on my household. Where does that leave us? That left Lot in stone. But where does that leave us in our own lives? In our own struggles of not being able to see things clearly. What light do we have to penetrate the darkness? So the obvious answer is 38, as descendants of Abraham who introduced the era of Torah, it is our task to toil in Torah, to discern truth from falsehood, light from darkness, the holy from the profane. And Rav Wubiale sure points this out in 39, the word olam itself comes from the concept of ha'alama, that which is concealed. We live in a world, yeshvo makom l'tayot rabot, where a lot of mistakes can happen because we live in such a dark, concealed world. Torah, which is or, which is light, allows us to see clearly. And that's how Rabbi Tatz in Living Inspired explains that when Adam was expelled from the garden, there were two turning swords, Cherev HaMitapechet, that were in front of the garden, which he explains in 41. The symbolism of the turning sword is a lethal weapon of doubt. Today one reality appears thus, and tomorrow different, always. And man cannot find the road back to the garden. The garden keeps eluding him. The road keeps on changing. What is our job? 42 requires a lifetime of separating good from bad, extracting the pure, the spiritual, the good, and ejecting evil for what it is. Our life's work is to strive for this clarity. Everything needs to be examined for its element of Kedusha, and that holiness extracted. So on a very simple level, not so simple, but simple anyway, what is our job? How do we counteract Lot? The answer is that we take the ability of the Torah, the guidance of the Torah, to be able to discern in everything we do, in all our actions, and ask ourselves, is this pure or impure? Is this holy or not holy? Is this something that's going to elevate me or not? The ability to take Torah's light and apply it to our lives. But I'd like to suggest, at the last part of this shiur, I think one step that comes before this. And I think this step is crucial in order to be successful. It's a prerequisite for any type of getting ourselves out of this light and darkness. And the answer to how to do this is the first two words of the parsha, of Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha is our answer to Lot. What is Lech Lecha all about? So we need to look at, again, the Siva Shalom, a Hasidic approach to open up our souls to what Lech Lecha is all about. Lech Lecha means go into yourself. Lech Lecha. Go to yourself. So here in the Nesiva Shalom quotes the beautiful Ari HaKadosh, who says that everyone in this world is created for a different mission, for a different job than everyone else. And everything that happens in our lives and all the vehicles we are given and the circumstances we're given in our lives are meant for us to grow as individuals, to be able to perfect self and the world around us. Everything. Whether we understand it or most of the times not. And he says so beautifully, he says, after 120 years, can you imagine a person who goes up to heaven? And God says, tell me something about your stay on earth. So he says, oh, I was a very firm Jew. Learned Torah, I kept mitzvot, I was great. So God says, and what else? What do you mean, what else? I kept Torah and mitzvot. What else do you want from me? So God says, you missed the boat. Torah and mitzvot were vehicles for you to accomplish something in this world. If we go to sleep at night and we can't answer the question, how have we grown this day? How have we made changes in this day? Then don't go to sleep that night. Do something about it. Because that's what we're here for. That's what we're here for. And continue to receive a shalom. The character traits that we have are also for this purpose. Sometimes we have difficult character traits within us, and the point is to overcome them, and through overcoming them, that's our job of growth in this world. Ah, so now we understand what Lech Lecha is all about. So he says, what is Lech Lecha all about? Go into yourself, where the arrow is in 46. Peirush lahagia el tikuna nishama. We need to reach the perfection of ourselves, hashayach elecha, that pertains to each individual, v'letachlit hamiyuedet elecha, and for the purpose that each individual was created. And the way to do that is alecha latzei ma'artzecha. You have to leave your land, umimoladetcha, and your birthplace, umibeis avicha, and from your father's home. Which he explains in 47 means certain character traits that we got from the land we live in, or certain types of people that we associate with have an influence on who we are as people. We need to step outside of this environment to perfect ourselves. It could be family traits. It could be traits that we got genetically, traits that we learned as children growing up in our family environment. One cannot say in life, well, what do you want from me? Genetically, I'm this way. We know people who say this. That's exactly what Lech Lecha is about. Lech Lecha means to be able to leave that which you've been so attached to and to grow from it and to become the person you can become from these experiences. So now that explains our question we had on the Medrash's question. 48. There are two types of nisyonos where the arrow is, trials, ha'omdim b'chaya adam, that stand in a person's life. Yesh et ha'milchama ha'tmidit, we have a constant battle, b'vchina lech lecha ma'artzecha. Constant battle to come to ourselves, to leave the tchunot ha'tiviyot, the natural negative characteristics we have, and this is a challenge and a test of every hour, shall kotzan vishal hareo mevin shenot, every moment of our lives. We're always being tested. We're always being challenged. If a person has the challenge of anger, so that every time they come into a potential conflict, so anger is going to raise up its head, that's an individual's challenge to overcome anger. What the Medrash is saying is, what is a greater challenge? Is it the challenge of every day of Lech Lecha coming to yourself? Is the challenge of every moment of our lives? Or is it the one-time challenge that all of us are challenged with of the Akedah of a major Nisayon of giving yourselves entirely to God? That's the question of the major. Which one is more Chavivam? Which one is more beloved to God? The everyday challenge or the once-in-a-lifetime challenge?
Suliya Chinami, the answer of the Medrash is, it's the once in a lifetime challenge, which is more precious because it's giving of your entire self to God, while the everyday challenge is you maintain the idea of self. But let us not diminish for one moment the fact that we have these things called everyday challenges. The call of Lech Lecha to Avram is a call to each and every one of us as a Jew. It's an eternal call. Every day we're told, Lech Lecha, go unto yourself, develop yourself, grow. And that's why he says in 50, V'ne'emar zo b'lashon halicha, that's why it's a language of walking. We had last week by Noach, Sein min ha-teva, leave the ark. Leaving means that we're focusing on that which I've come from. Lech lecha, to go, means I'm focusing on that which where I'm going to go, the intended purpose. Laharot, to teach us, shezet tafkido shel Yehudi, this is the job of every individual. Lalecha, to go, v'lihitkadem atzmo legamrei, and to always move forward. And that's why it says in the Siva Shalom, we have the concept of walking three times in Avraham's life. The beginning of his career, lech lecha. The end of our parasha, hitalech lefanai ve'yet tamim, the middle of his life, walk with me and be perfect. And the end of his life, of lech lecha al Eretz Samaria, go unto the mountain. What life is about, says in Siva Shalom, is that one word, lech lecha, to go, that one phrase. To always be moving. That's what distinguishes us from angels who are omdim, who stand, is the fact that we're always hulking, we're always moving. And if we're not moving, we're in trouble. If we're not moving, we're in trouble. Life is about growing. Life is about lech lecha. Life is about being ready to grow and ready to move. This is the prerequisite before we can even take the power of Torah. Do we want to grow? Are we interested in separating the good from the bad? Are we interested in going through the difficult experience of looking for potentials of light and to try to weed them out from darkness? I learned this lesson so clearly, and so many lessons, from our little one, Kanina Hara, 11 months old. Friday night, I guess with the time changes, we went to sleep early, 4 o'clock in the morning, we're wide awake, having chicken and rice. Nothing better to do. Apartment's pitch black, we can't read. There's only one light on in the bathroom. So, obviously, our daughter senses, if my parents are up, party time. I'm going to be up too. And normally, she likes to be around us. But Friday night, she was crawling continually to the light. I said, ah, what a lesson. What a lesson. This is it. We're drawn by instinct as a little baby to what? To light. But we're also drawn to the fact of halicha, of always moving toward the light. That's what life is about. Life is about movement, and life is about looking for the light. When an 11-month-old knows instinctively, that's what we have to have as our barometer of moving in our lives. Ah, and that explains so beautifully our question about Lot. Why does it begin off that section saying, and Lot who walked with Abraham? That's the problem. Externally, he was walking with Abraham. Internally, he wasn't moving an inch. And that's why Abraham says, we resemble each other. It looks like we're going the same way. We're both traveling. You're traveling with me. And that's why we need to separate while I'm traveling and moving and ready to grow and ready to accept challenges and grow from them. You're just externally walking with me, but there's no inner growth, inner change that's going on within you. And I'd like to conclude with a little piece from this book, The Jewish Self, where at the end of his introduction he says, talking about trying to understand ourselves and recover spirituality within ourselves, source 51, he says, the potential gain is the acquisition of self and a sense for its meaning, significance, and place in the world. If our own anxious doubts in this area are not motivation enough, let us remember that the only truly valuable gift that we can give our children is ourself. What are we to give them if we have them?